Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone Smoke Jensen, The Mountain Man Number 33, Destiny of the Mountain Man. Narrated by Mort Shelby, with performances by James Lewis, Bradley Smith, Mort Shelby, Tim Getman, Drew Kopitz, Elizabeth Jernigan, Richard Rowan, Tim Carlin, Nick DePinto, David Coyne, Alexander Strain, Michael Glenn, Katie Karkoff, Kimberly Gilbert, Eric Messner, Terrence Aselford, Christopher Sheeran, Ken Jackson, Christopher Graybill, and Johan Detweiler.
The Golden Nugget Saloon in Pueblo, Colorado Territory, was already a beehive of activity, even though the regulator clock sitting against the back wall indicated that it was just after 12 o'clock in the afternoon. Two men slapped the bat wings open, stepped into the saloon, and crossed over to the bar. Everyone in the place paused and stared at the pair as they made their way across the room. They looked like perfect examples of what life in the mountains would do to anyone crazy enough or antisocial enough to endure it. The older of the two had fought in the Battle of New Orleans as a 14-year-old boy. The younger of the two was a boy during the Civil War, which had been over but 5 years. Despite their age differences, there was a strong similarity between them. Both were dressed in buckskins that were almost black and accumulated trail dust and dirt and grime. Both had full beards and long, unkempt hair that hung down almost to their shoulders. The older man's hair was white, while the younger man's hair was the color of dark smoke. It was obvious from their appearance and smell that they'd been up in the high country for some time without benefit of a bath. They belonged to that most reclusive of breeds, mountain men. But it wasn't the fact that they were mountain men that caused everyone in the Golden Nugget Saloon to stop what they were doing and stare. Mountain men weren't all that rare in this part of the Colorado Territory, especially in winter when storms would sometimes drift the snow deep enough to drive even those hardy souls down to civilization. What caught everyone's attention was the fact that they were armed to the teeth. The old man was carrying what looked to be a Sharps Big 50 cradled in his arms, and a Navy Colt 37 stuck down in his belt. The younger one had enough weapons to start a war. A Navy Colt was tied down low on his thigh in a right-hand rig. A matching Colt was butt forward in a high holster on his left hip, and a 12-inch long bowie knife rested in a scabbard in the middle of his back. A Henry repeating rifle was slung across his shoulders to complete the picture. The young man's eyes were as hard and uncompromising as new ice on a pond, while the older man's expression was one of whimsy, as if he'd seen just about all that was worth seeing in his many years and saw little now that would impress him. When the older man set his rifle down and they both leaned on the bar, all but one of the saloon customers went back to what they were doing, ignoring the two odd-looking newcomers. One of the customers, however, Bradford Preston, continued to stare at the two. Though it was still early in the day, Preston had already had more than enough to drink. If you asked, Preston would call himself a cowboy, though he found work only sporadically. Due to his temper, hard-headedness, and the fact that not many cattlemen trusted him. It had never been proven, but there were those who suspected that Preston would sometimes support himself by cutting out a few head of cattle, butchering them, then selling the meat and the hide. Preston drained his glass and slammed it down on the table, nodding his head at one of the others sitting with him to refill it from the almost empty bottle on the table.
Damn, Johnny. Smells like a skunk done up and died in here. Why don't somebody open up some windows or something to get the stink of those two mountain hombres out of my nose?
The younger man's back stiffened and he started to turn around until the older man put a hand on his arm.
Take her easy, Smoke. Just a young pup, too much whiskey in his gullet, trying to impress his friends. If you try and shut all them kind of beavers up, you'll wind up taking a job you ain't never gonna be able to finish.
Smoke Jensen nodded and took a deep breath as he looked at Preacher and grinned.
Now I know why we spend so much time up in the High Lonesome away from assholes like that.
Preston jumped to his feet, wobbled for a second, and then walked over to stand just behind Smoke.
Hey, you stinking pile of shit. Did you just call me an asshole?
Oh, now fat's in the fire.
Yeah, I did.
Preston blinked a couple of times. He had expected Smoke to deny it or talk around it. Hell, at least show some anxiety over being called down on it. He didn't expect the young man to show such dead, cool calm.
Them's fighting words, mister.
You're too drunk. If you want to fight, get a wife. My partner and I just want to have a couple of beers in peace and be on our way.
That ain't gonna happen now. I'm calling you.
Preston slapped at his pistol. Before he could clear leather, Smoke's pistol was in his hand, and taking a step forward, he laid the barrel of his Colt across the drunken man's cheekbone.
Anyone else here object to my friend and me having a quiet drink?
Smoke reached down, pulled Preston to his feet, and looked at the bleeding wound on his face.
You boys might want to take your friend over to see a doctor. That cut's gonna need some stitches.
The men hustled over and took their friend out of the bar.
You better hurry up and drink it, Smoke. I don't figure we got too long before somebody's gonna inform the sheriff that we're here.
Smoke nodded. He still had a price on his head up in Utah from when he'd taken on the gang of outlaws. He never knew just where those pesky wanted posters were gonna turn up. Preacher was right. It was better to drink up and be on their way before trouble found them again. And, he had noticed, trouble did have a way of finding them if they tried to stay planted for too long in one place. It seemed you could outrun a man or a posse, but you could never outrun your reputation. Smoke had just put his empty beer glass down on the bar when a group of several men crowded through the saloon bat wings and gathered in the doorway. The man at the head of the pack was a couple of inches over 6 feet tall, and he had wide shoulders, a beer gut that hung over his belt, and a greener 10-gauge shotgun cradled in his arms. Johnny Dean, one of the men who had been with Preston, came in with the sheriff, but he made a point to be standing behind him. From that position, he pointed toward Smoke and Preacher.
There they are, Sheriff, just like I told you. Them's the two men were pistol whipped poor old Preston and damn near tore his cheek plumb off in his face.
Smoke stared at his accuser, and trembling, Johnny took a few steps back.
Sorry, Preacher. It looks like we might have waited too long.
Yeah, I think you're right. But I do believe the bear was worth it.
The man Dean had called Sheriff raised his shotgun to point at him.
I'm Sheriff Tom Jackson, boys, and I'd be obliged if you dropped them irons on the floor. We don't take kindly around here to strangers coming into our town and assaulting our citizens.
Without speaking or looking at each other, Smoke and Preacher eased apart until they were separated by a few yards.
Sorry, Sheriff, but we won't be dropping our guns.
Are you boys blind? You do see what I'm holding, don't you?
Looks like a W.W. Greener 10-gauge double-barrel shotgun to me. What do you think, Preacher?
Oh, I'd say you're right, yeah. You remember that old Dooley had him at Greener just like that?
Yeah, I do remember. Whatever happened to Dooley anyway?
Oh, don't you remember? He married up with that Injun woman he had took to living with. I think they went up to Dakota territory somewhere.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
The sheriff followed the conversation, turning from one to the other as they spoke. The expression on his face went from curiosity to incredulity.
What the hell? Are you two men daft? You're carrying on a conversation like you're taking a walk around town. You do see that I got this gun pointed at your guts, don't you?
Which one of us?
What?
What my friend is trying to tell you, Sheriff, is that you ain't cut the barrel down none.
What's that supposed to mean?
What it means, Sheriff Jackson, is that if you pull the trigger on that thing, you're gonna die. Same as if you was to put the end of the barrel in your mouth.
What? My God, are you totally crazy?
Maybe I should explain. Because you haven't cut the barrel down, your scattergun's gonna throw a pretty tight pattern at this distance. That means you can only get one of us if you pull the trigger.
And that means, Pilgrim, that before the echoes of your shot are done bouncing off these walls, you'll be lying dead on the floor, no matter which one of us you shoot. And in all likelihood, a whole bunch of your town folks are gonna get killed in the process, too.
Johnny Dean started easing away from the sheriff and the possible line of fire.
Won't do you any good to move, friend. You'll be next one killed right after the sheriff.
What? Why me?
Because you're the one who brought the sheriff over here.
I don't believe either of you two are that fast.
Oh, Sheriff, I kind of forgot to mention that man's name there on the left is Smoke Jensen. I do believe I heard him call the other gent Preacher.
You men are Smoke Jensen and Preacher?
That's right.
What do you got to say for yourself about slapping a pistol in Preston's face?
Oh, you know Preston, do you, Sheriff?
I know him.
What kind of man is he?
What do you mean?
I mean, if you know him, do you really think my friend here just slapped him for the fun of it? Or do you think maybe Preston might have brought it on himself?
I reckon he's the kind that might have brought it on himself.
He tried to draw down on me. And it was either slap some sense into him or shoot him dead. Would you rather I'd killed him?
Before the sheriff could answer, a thin young man in a suit and vest stood up from a corner table.
Sheriff Jackson, if I may. I witnessed the entire episode, and I can vouch for the veracity of these gentlemen's account.
Say what?
What I'm saying is that they're telling the truth. My name is Robert Justice Kleberg, and I am chief counsel for the governor of the Colorado Territory.
Oh, well, if the lawyer for the governor says he's telling the truth...
But, Sheriff, Jensen's got price on his head. Everybody knows that. You got to arrest him and put his ass in jail where it belongs.
You want me to take a chance on getting my ass killed just so you can collect some reward?
Well, that's your job, ain't it?
Kleberg leaned close to the sheriff, whispered a few words in his ear, and the sheriff nodded, relief evident on his face.
Mr. Kleberg here says he's going to take Mr. Jensen and his friend over to the hotel to meet with the governor, and that'll be the end of it.
But
my advice to you, Johnny, is to shut up before I run you in for disturbing the peace. You and that drunk Preston are the ones started all this in the first place. Now let's get the hell out of here and let Mr. Kleberg do his job.
Once the sheriff, Dean, and Preston's other friends were gone, Kleberg walked up to Smoke and handed him one of his cards.
Mr. Jensen? Preacher, if you don't mind coming with me over to the hotel, I'd like you to meet the governor.
Well, they got a bar in that there hotel because I got me some trail dust needs washing out of my throat.
I am sure libations can be arranged.
Smoke and Preacher followed Kleberg out of the saloon.
Say, Mr. Kleberg, any particular reason you want us to talk to the governor?
First, please call me Bob. When I hear someone say Mister, I always look around to see who they're talking to.
Smoke glanced at Preacher and grinned. He was beginning to like this young man. He wasn't so full of himself like so many of the lawyers Smoke had met in the past.
Sure, Bob, but that didn't answer my question.
I know. This way.
Kleberg showed him through the large doors that led into the Palace Hotel. Then they went straight across the lobby toward a room off to the side.
Since it's lunchtime, I suspect he'll be here in the dining room.
Dining room? Hell, I ain't hungry. I'm thirsty.
As they walked past a man wearing a suit coat and a horrified expression on his face, Kleberg snapped at him.
Pierre, bring my friends here anything they want to eat or drink. We'll be at the governor's table.
The man gave him a nervous nod.
What would you gentlemen like to drink?
A couple of beers would be nice.
Yep, I'll have a sing.
The waiter looked at him as if he hadn't quite understood the order.
Bring them two beers, Pierre. Each. Didn't you hear what they said?
The man nodded and quickly hurried off. Moments later, they were standing before a large round table, at which sat a rotund man in a three-piece suit of black wool. He wore his hair rather long, and he had a large ornate mustache that drooped down almost to his chin. At first glance, he was a typical politician, Smoke thought, self-important and arrogant. However, when the man raised his eyes, he didn't gasp at their soiled appearance or ask Kleberg what he meant by bringing such disreputable-appearing men before him. Instead, he smiled, got to his feet, and held out his hand.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I'm Governor William Gilpin, but please, call me Bill.
Hello, Governor. I'm Smoke Jensen, and they call this old reprobate next to me Preacher.
I ain't old. You're just a wet-behind-the-ears pup is all.
You're the Smoke Jensen?
Only one I know of.
Forgive me for staring, Mr. Jensen, but I didn't realize you were so young.
Well, he's young, but he's been rode hard and put up wet, Governor, and he's got an awful lot of miles on him.
Gilpin smiled and motioned to the chairs around the table.
So I hear, Preacher. So I hear. Please have a seat, gentlemen. Did Bob tell you we'd been talking about you the last couple of days?
No, he didn't.
Oh, no offense, Mr. Jensen. We were just remarking that there are some men in the territory who have, shall we say, have had more than their share of life's experiences.
He paused while the waiters brought in a tray with four beers.
Kleberg, you know I never drink beer.
All four beers are for these two gentlemen.
Then by all means enjoy them, gentlemen. Would you care for some lunch?
Yeah, I could use me a beefsteak, just charred enough to keep it from moving. Some fried taters, maybe some canned peaches if you have them.
Preacher dearly loves canned peaches. I'll have the same.
The waiter looked at Gilpin.
Bring them what they want.
You were saying something about our life's experiences?
Yes. You see, gentlemen, Congress and President Grant are going to make Colorado Territory a state any time now. And it's my feeling that men like yourselves, men who've helped tame this country and make it safe for Easterners, are going to be sorely needed in the next few years.
You hiring outlaws, Governor?
No, you misunderstand me. Bob has gathered a stack of warrants and wanted posters on most of the wanted men in Colorado. And we've investigated the charges against them and found most of them valid. We aren't interested in those men, but from what we can tell, Mr. Jensen, every time you've been charged with murder, you've been acting in self-defense.
Well now, Governor, I wouldn't exactly go that far. It's true that I've never killed a man that wasn't trying to kill me at the time, but I gotta admit that some of those times, I kind of forced their hands a mite.
We know, Smoke, and we found out that every one of those times, the men you killed had wronged you first by killing someone in your family.
He's right there, son. Ain't neither one of us ever killed nobody that didn't deserve it, and deserve it in spades.
So, we all agree. We're a couple of saints, but just what do you have in mind, Governor?
You tell him, Bob, it was your idea.
The governor is going to issue you both full pardons for all crimes you've been charged with up to now. You'll both start with a clean slate as far as the law is concerned.
We're certainly grateful for that, Governor, but just what do you expect from us in return?
Nothing, son. Absolutely nothing. Just go on doing what you've been doing. The stories of your exploits and the exploits of men like you will do more to bring civilization to this territory than all the government bureaucrats in Washington can.
You see, Smoke, when ordinary men back east read about your adventures, they will want to come west to live like that themselves.
Well, Bob, let me tell you, it reads a whole hell of a lot better than it lives.
Ten years later, nearly 2,500 cows stood quietly in the pre-dawn darkness, gathered during the spring roundup. The cows gathered represented but a tiny percentage of the over 100,000 head that occupied the rangeland of the 825,000-acre Santa Gertrudis Ranch. When 7,500 more head were gathered, Richard King, the owner of the ranch, would start the long, long trail drive up to Dodge City, Kansas, where the cattle would be put on trains from markets in the east. From the small breakfast fire the cook had kindled, glowing orange sparks rode a column of hot air to join the stars in the pre-dawn darkness. One of the cowboys at the camp reached for a coffee pot, but he jerked his hand back quickly when he touched the handle. Ted Abbott smiled.
Hot, is it, Carter?
Not all that hot.
Carter took his hat off and, using it as protection, he picked up the coffee pot a second time.
Anybody else want any?
Gracias, Carter. I'll take a cup.
Though Ramon Gonzalez was a Mexican in the midst of a bunch of Texans, he was the top hand, appointed to the position by Richard King, the owner of the ranch, and readily acknowledged as such by the other cowboys.
And I, too, shall imbibe of your fair brew.
Harbin, you are as full of shit as a Christmas goose.
It's about time they come in, isn't it?
Hell, they're probably on the other side of the herd, sound asleep.
Ramon, you made cattle drives before. How long does it take?
2 months.
That's not so bad for you, Abbott. You're going back east to go to school. You won't be making a drive.
I've never made a drive. What's it like?
It's like nothing you've ever done. You'll be working 17-hour days, 7 days a week on very little grub with no tents, no tarps, and damn few slickers. The horses will get tired and their backs will get so sore that they'll fight you when you ride them. And the worst thing is no sleep. 5 hours when the weather is nice, maybe an hour when it isn't. But that don't matter, because you'll have to do another 15 miles the next day whether you got no sleep the night before or not. Sometimes you'll find yourself rubbing tobacco juice in your eyes just to keep awake.
Oh, damn, that hurts just to think about it.
On the other side of the herd, nearly 60 men rode through the dark of a copse of scrub oak trees. Shadows within shadows, they moved quietly to the edge of the trees, then fanned out into one long flanking line. The leader of the group was wearing a Union officer's jacket of the style worn some 15 years earlier during the Civil War. His shoulder epaulettes had major's bars on a yellow field, indicating cavalry. Jack Brandt, who was no longer in the army, but still insisted upon being called major, stood in his stirrups to stretch out a bit. Then he settled back into the saddle.
Look at all them cows. What do you say, Major, that we cut out 100 head or so, then run them across the border and sell them down in Mexico?
No.
But to just ride down there and kill them seems like such waste.
Preston, you knew what you were signing up for when you enlisted.
Although Brandt was no longer in the Army, he ran his outfit as if it were an Army unit. Because of that, suggesting that the man had enlisted came natural to him.
You heard the Major's plans.
Like Brandt, the man, whose real name was Stone, but who preferred to be called Sarge, was wearing a blue army tunic. On his sleeves were the stripes of the rank he'd once held.
All we have to do is fix it so nobody will work for him and he'll go broke plain and simple. Then we'll have our revenge.
Yeah, well, revenge is good, but it don't buy you no whiskey or women.
Think about it, Preston. In a few weeks, he's going to be driving 10,000 head or so all the way to Kansas. If he don't have nobody to work them cows, they'll be as easy to gather up as apples that's fallen from a tree. You were talking about stealing 100 head. Hell, we'll be able to take 10,000 head with no problem.
Yeah, I guess I can see that.
Brandt, who had not joined the conversation, pulled his sword.
It's not dawn yet, so like as not, the night riders are still out there. We'll take them first.
Of the three Nighthawks, Noble, who was 19, was the oldest. At 16, Tanner was the youngest. The horse appeared from the darkness.
That's Noble's horse. Where is he?
Gillis rode toward him. Then he suddenly stopped.
Oh my God! Oh my God!
What is it?
Then Tanner saw what Gillis had seen. There, mounted on the saddle horn, was the disembodied head of Ned Noble.
Harbin, I think you, Jenkins, and Kelly should ride out to relieve Noble and the others. They should be in by now.
Suddenly, a very large group of men burst out of the trees. Harbin went down with the opening fusillade. The men swept through, firing as they galloped through the camp. One of them had a rope, and he passed the chuck wagon. He threw the rope around the high stake and then pulled the wagon over. The cowboys were totally surprised by the attack, and many of them weren't even wearing guns. The few who were armed began firing back. The attackers made two more passes through the camp. Then they rode out into the herd, shooting at the cattle as they rode by. The cattle began dropping.
My God, they're killing the cattle!
Who the hell are these people? Where did they come from?
I don't know, but there sure as hell is a lot of them. Ramon, we need to get mounted. We need to get after them. Ramon!
Looking over at Ramon, Carter saw the top hand leaning back against the overturned wagon. Ramon's right arm was hanging down by his side, his pistol dangling from a crooked finger. His left hand was covering a wound on his right shoulder, and blood was spilling through his fingers. By now, the attackers had passed through the herd and rode off on the far side of the valley. Cattle, spooked by all the shooting, were milling around, but had not stampeded, thank God.
I think they're gone.
Emil, ride back to the big house. Tell Mr. King what just happened.
All right, but you better get yourself into town and get that bullet hole looked at.
I'll see that he does. You better get started.
Richard King had never done anything on a small scale. When he was 11 years old, he became dissatisfied with his apprenticeship in New York, and he stowed away on a schooner. Discovered, he had to work for his passage. After a few years learning the shipping trade from the bottom up, including becoming a captain, King took a partner and formed his own shipping company. By the late 1840s, his company was shipping supplies for General Zachary Taylor along the Rio Grande. Enamored with Texas, Captain King settled down there, started ranching, and by 1860, he and his new bride, Henrietta, had grown their various enterprises into an 860,000-acre ranch along the banks of the Santa Gertrudis River in Texas. Ever the businessman, King invested in building railroads, ice houses, packing houses, and harbor improvements in Corpus Christi, Texas, which was just about 40 miles from his ranch. Now, the ranch owner was planning the logistics of a cattle drive to Dodge City, Kansas. He'd considered shipping them to Kansas by rail, but the circuitous railroad route it would require to make all the connections would take 2 weeks, and it would cost him approximately $4 per head, or $40,000. Driving the herd to Dodge would take 8 weeks, but it would only cost him about $3,000 total. King was sitting at his desk, working out the logistics of the drive, when Emil Barrett came in to see him. Standing in front of the big oak desk, holding his hat in his hands and nervously rolling it by the rim, he made his report to his boss. Barrett's jeans and shirt were covered with dirt and dust, and he smelled of sweating cows. But Captain Richard King took no notice of that. He did wonder why the young cowboy was here instead of out on the range helping with the roundup.
What are you doing here, Barrett?
Captain, we got trouble.
What sort of trouble?
Barrett told him of the pre-dawn attack.
Well, how about you, Barrett? You all right?
Yes, sir, I'm fine. I would have been out there with the others if Ramon hadn't sent me back to bring you the news.
Ramon was right, and you did well. Go to the kitchen, get yourself some coffee, and whatever you want to eat.
Thank you, sir.
King stood up from behind the enormous oak desk in its study. He was an imposing figure of a man. Almost 6 feet tall, he had broad shoulders and heavily muscled forearms that made the paunch he was developing in his later years seem smaller. His hair was streaked with gray and was beginning to thin out a bit on top, but his mustache was thick and black and still full. He walked over to a clothes tree in the corner where there hung a right-handed holster rig. Taking it down, he buckled it around his waist with the familiar motion of someone who'd worn a gun before. He pulled the Colt Peacemaker from the holster and spun the cylinder to make certain that every chamber was loaded. Satisfied, he put the gun back into its sheath, then took a large Stetson hat from the rack. He placed it on his head and adjusted the brim before walking out of his study and into a slightly smaller office next door. Robert Justice Kleberg looked up from his desk and frowned when he saw the old man wearing his sidearm.
Going hunting, boss?
Kleberg was young, in his mid-30s, and rail thin without an ounce of fat on his 6-foot-1-inch frame. His face was pleasant without being classically handsome, and his hair, the color of caramel candy, was slightly rumpled in front, as if he'd been out in a strong wind.
Get your pistol and follow me, Bob. Seems that we have a problem.
Kleberg looked slightly startled. King had hired him a couple of years earlier to handle the legal tasks for his San Gertrudis ranch, and as such, his duties didn't normally entail wearing a pistol. Not that it mattered much. Kleberg had grown up in the nearby town of Corpus Christi, which was a haven at the time for Mexican bandidos and Civil War deserters. So he'd been proficient with a 6-gun from the time he was old enough to carry one. Kleberg took his holster and pistol rig off a peg in the wall and blew the dust off before he buckled it around his hips. He started to put his suit coat on, but he decided against it since it looked as if he and the old man were going for a ride. No need to get the coat dusty and dirty. As they walked through the enormous rooms of the ranch house, Alice King, Richard's daughter, stepped out of the kitchen with a pastry in one hand and a cup of steaming coffee in the other.
Where are you two going? I was just bringing Bob a pan dulce and a cup of coffee.
In spite of his sour mood, King grinned. He loved his daughter with every fiber of his being. And to make matters even better, he approved of her choice of Bob Kleberg as the man in her life. He knew Kleberg to be smart, ambitious, fearless, and he also knew that Kleberg loved his daughter as much as he did, which was just the icing on the cake. Kleberg stepped quickly to her side and took the sweet roll from her hand.
Well, thank you, Alice. Your father is going to show me something, and I'll eat it on the way.
But, Bob, why are you wearing a gun?
There's been some rustlers seen out on the range, dear. We're just being cautious. Nothing for you to worry about. We'll be back before you have time to miss us.
Before I have time to miss you? Well, that won't take very long, Papa.
Come on, Bobby. We're burning daylight.
King and Kleberg rode for almost an hour until they finally came to the banks of the Santa Gertrudis River. The river, for which the ranch had been named, was running swiftly over rocks and sandbars, and while it was deep as 8 feet in some places, here it was only about 3 feet deep. They urged their horses out into the water, rode across quickly, then climbed up onto the bank on the other side. From there, they could see the cow camp, where the cows to be driven north were being gathered. Several men were standing around the wagon. One of the wheels was broken on the wagon, and the side was stoved in. It was obvious, even to the most casual observer, that the wagon had been turned over and set back upright. As it got closer, we saw at least 30 cows, maybe more, lying sprawled in the pasture. Closer still, and they saw a row of bodies lined up neatly on blankets. 5 were uncovered, 3 were covered by tarpaulins. Carter came out to meet them.
Damn, how many?
We had 8 killed.
Oh, shit. Stan Harbin was one of them.
Yes, sir.
I just got a nice letter from his mother. He was going back east to go to college.
Yes, sir, he's telling us about it. Going around here quoting poetry and all that.
King saw 2 other bodies lying to one side. They had been drawn together, but they weren't lying on a blanket or even a tarp.
Those 2 part of the rustlers?
Yes, sir. Sort of.
Sort of? What do you mean, sort of?
Well, sir, they was part of the group that attacked us, but they wasn't exactly rustlers. Leastwise, not so as you could call them as such.
Well, if they weren't rustlers, what were they?
I don't know as I can rightly answer that question. They just come in here and commence shooting. Wasn't interested in stealing nothing, as far as I could tell. All they's interested in is killing as many of us as they could. They shot the hell out of us, along with all the beeves they could hit. It wasn't nothing more than a slaughter. I mean, what with us not suspecting anything at all? Most of us wasn't even wearing guns at the time.
Well, that wasn't very smart, was it? Not wearing your guns, I mean.
Captain King, it was just breaking dawn. We just rolled out of our blankets. And why would we need our guns then? I mean, who would have thought?
I'm sorry. Of course you wouldn't be armed. And why should you be? I shouldn't have said anything.
Well, here's the thing, Captain. Two of them fellas was wearing army uniforms.
Army uniforms? Wait a minute. Are you telling me the army did this?
No, sir. I don't think so. I mean, they was only two of them wearing anything like that, and they was just wearing the jackets of uniforms is all.
I'll be damned. That's strange. I don't see Ramon. Where is he? Is he all right?
Well, as far as I know, he is. He took a bullet in the shoulder and never said nothing about it till he'd already seen all the others. I talked him into letting one of the boys take him into Benavides on a buckboard so as the doc could take a look at it. He still didn't want to leave, but I told him there wasn't nothing more he could do out here.
You did right to send him into town. How many would you say there were in the group that did this?
Oh, hell of a lot of them. That's all I can tell you. There's just a hell of a lot of them.
What, 5, 10, 20?
More than 20. More than 50, I'd say.
50? Are you telling me that 50 men did this?
At least 50. Maybe more.
Bob, what the hell are we facing here? Who would get 50 men together to steal a few cows?
Especially since they didn't steal any.
That was when King saw that three of the bodies were covered. He turned back to Carter.
Who were the three men under the tarps?
That's Noble, Gillis, and Tanner. The only thing is, we ain't real sure which one is which.
What do you mean?
They ain't got no heads.
What?
They ain't got no heads. Their heads was cut off.
Their heads were cut off?
Yes, sir.
I wonder if... No, it can't be.
What can't be?
Yeah, nothing. It probably isn't the same thing at all. I'm sure I'm just imagining things.
What are we going to do about all these fellas that was killed?
Send someone into town to get the undertaker and bring them back to the ranch. We're going to give them a decent burial and find their heads.
Yes, sir. We need to do something about the cows that was killed, too.
Take the hides, get what meat you think we can use, and get them in a pile and burn them.
And what about them two galoots?
King looked over toward the two bodies of the raiders.
Burn them with the cows.
Smoke Jensen was in Longmont's enjoying a beer when someone stepped inside.
Smoke!
I'm over here, Monty.
Smoke was sharing a table with Lewis Longmont, the owner of Longmont Saloon and Restaurant.
Maybe you better step outside, Smoke. There's a couple of fellas out there giving Miss Sally a hard time.
Are they town people?
No, I ain't never seen either one of them before.
Still carrying his beer, Smoke walked over to the front door and stood there, looking over the top of the bat wings out into the street. He took a swallow of his beer.
Ain't you gonna go out there and help her?
Nah, there's only two of them. Yeah, let Sally fight her own fight.
What do you think, Spieg? You think you can show this little lady a good time?
Well, that ain't the question, Hoke. Question is she gonna show us a good time?
Hoke was standing at the hitching rail, holding on to the team that had pulled Sally's buckboard into town. Spieg was alongside the buckboard, and both of them were smiling up at Sally Jensen, who was sitting in the buckboard seat.
Let go of my team.
Nah. I don't want to do that. If I do that, you might run off before we have a chance to get to know each other.
Yeah. If you get to know us a little better, why, you'd like us.
I doubt that even your mother's like you.
Ooh-wee. She's a feisty little thing, ain't she, Hoke?
I like 'em feisty. What do you say, little lady? Let me and you and Speak there get us a bottle and go off and have us a good time somewhere?
I don't suppose it matters to you that I'm married.
Nope. Don't matter to us none at all.
You see, we ain't exactly wanting to marry you. We just want to borrow you for a bit.
Yeah, that's what we want. We want to borrow you for a bit.
Sally took the whip from its holder.
I'm warning you. Go away and leave me alone.
And if we don't?
Moving more quickly than Spieg could react, Sally jammed the butt of the whip into Spieg's nose, breaking it.
What the hell?
Oh, what, you bitch!
Sally shot Spig's hat off. She sensed Hoke coming toward her, but she didn't turn to face him. Instead, she aimed her pistol at Spig's groin.
Unless you want to squat to pee for the rest of your life, you'll call your friend off.
Hope? No, wait, hold it!
You two men are strangers to our little town, aren't you?
Yes.
Ma'am?
What?
When you speak to me, it's yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
I thought so. And that being the case, I think everyone would be happy to see the two of you climb up onto your horses and leave.
You ain't the sheriff. You don't have no right to run us out of town.
What about it, Mr. Speeg? Do I have the right?
Oh, yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am, what?
You, got the right to run us out of town. Come on, Hulk, let's get out of here. There ain't nothing worth seeing in this no-count town nohow.
Hulk and Speeg mounted their horses and rode down Center Street until they reached the edge of town. Then, urging their mounts into a gallop, they rode away quickly. Sally stayed on the buckboard, keeping an eye on them until they were well down the road. Not until then did she drive over to Longmont's.
Why, did you ever see the man's sister? No wonder she isn't married. Her eyebrows alone would stop a man dead in his tracks at 50 paces.
Looking up, Smoke saw Sally coming in.
Hello, Sally. All finished with your shopping, are you?
All finished.
Well then, friends, I guess it's time for us to get back out to the Sugarloaf.
We'll see you around.
See ya.
Stan Harbin's body was taken into Corpus Christi, where it was put on a train and shipped back to his parents in Kentucky. The other seven were brought out to the ranch, where funeral services would be conducted in the ranch chapel. King had built the chapel before the war to accommodate the more than 150 employees of his ranch. Most, but not all, of his employees were Mexican. In fact, he had once relocated an entire Mexican village which was dying because of a prolonged drought. The relocated village, reconstructed about a quarter of a mile away and separated from the main house by the barn, machine shed, granary, smokehouse, bunkhouse, and kitchen, consisted of more than 30 homes, identical in size and shape. All were green with red roofs. The residents of that village, which had the unofficial name of King's Settlement, were exceptionally loyal employees, believing rightly that King was their great benefactor. Babies were born there, old people died there, and gradually, a little graveyard just outside the chapel began to fill up with the departed. Now, seven more graves were about to be added to the ranch graveyard. Even before dawn on the day of the funeral, visitors began arriving at the ranch. Most came from Benavides or San Diego, but many came from farther away, and those who did camped on the ranch itself. Some of them hadn't camped at all, but rode or drove through the night to get there. King had thought to have a private funeral, but when the word got out that there were 10 men killed in a shootout on the ranch, it spread through Duval County, as well as the neighboring counties of Nueces, Encino, McMullen, Zapata, Starr, and Hidalgo. Some people had even come from Mexico, and many came from Corpus Christi. There were far too many people for the chapel to hold, so priority was given to those who actually lived and worked on the ranch. The others gathered outside the chapel, content just to be there and be present for the actual interment. The main house, called the Casa Grande by the Mexican and American cowboys alike, was a large two-story edifice with a porch all the way around the front at the ground level and an equally large balcony across the front at the second floor level. Richard King and Robert Kleberg were sitting on that front porch watching as the people arrived for the funeral. Already dressed for the funeral, both men were wearing black suits with black string ties.
What are all these people doing here?
They've come to pay their respects.
But why? I doubt that any of them ever knew any of the men that were killed.
I think they are paying their respects to you.
To me? Why on earth would they do that?
You are an important man in these parts.
Henrietta, King's wife, and Alice, his daughter, came out onto the front porch then. Like the men, the two women were appropriately dressed for the funeral, not only wearing black dresses, but black veils as well. Henrietta offered her arm to her husband, while Kleberg stood to take Alice's arm. Inside the chapel, King and those with him were greeted by Padre Bustamante, the priest at the little church in Benavides. Bustamante took King and the others down the aisle to the front row, then held out his hand, bidding them to sit. There were 7 closed coffins elevated on sawhorses in front of the sanctuary. Bustamante took his place at the front of the chapel, then began the funeral mass. King did not understand the Latin, so instead of listening to the words, he listened to the rhythm of the delivery. He allowed his thoughts to drift back to the war, when once before tragedy had struck the little community of ranch workers who resided on his ranch. Returning from a cattle buying trip in Mexico, King discovered that 23 of his people had been slaughtered during a raid by the Union Army. Not only were many slaughtered, but several of the women, including the young girls, had been brutally raped.
Who could do such a terrible thing?
El Carnicero.
At the time, Ramon had not been King's foreman, but because the foreman had been one of those killed, Ramon was promoted on the spot.
El Carnicero? The butcher?
Si, the butcher. Anyone who kills in such a way is a butcher.
Are you sure he was in the army?
Si. He was in the army and he carried a big sword. It is with a sword that he corté las cabezas of the people.
He cut off the heads of the people.
King came back from his reverie.
Exactly like the man who led this attack upon his ranch. Could it possibly be the same one?
The 7 coffins were transported out the chapel to the adjacent cemetery. There, even those who had not been able to get into the church were able to gather around to pay their respects and express their sorrow over the loss of so many young lives. King stayed in the cemetery until the graveside services were concluded, and not until dirt was being shoveled onto the caskets did he, his family, and Kleberg start back to the main house. Once Henrietta and Alice were back inside the house, King and Kleberg sat again on the chairs on the front porch. They watched as the people began leaving the funeral. Kleberg shook his head.
Richard, we've got to do something about this.
I know. I just don't know what yet.
If you would like, I can go to Corpus Christi tomorrow and call in the Rangers.
No, don't do that.
No, why not?
Well, for one thing, I think I know who did this. And if I'm right, he's making it personal.
Who?
Someone that my people call the Butcher.
King told the story of the raid against his ranch during the war.
It was a regular army unit, not a band of guerrillas.
Regular army, yes. But Major Brandt and Sergeant Stone were court-martialed and sent away to prison.
For how long?
I thought for the rest of their lives. And they may still be there. I don't know, maybe I'm just letting an active imagination get the better of me. For all I know, Brandt is still in prison, or dead.
Well, then, if I go into Corpus Christi, I can find out for you.
Yes, I think I'd like that.
It was at that very moment that Alice came back out onto the porch.
Did I just hear Bob say he was going to Corpus Christi?
Were you standing just inside the door listening?
No, I was just coming out to see if you wanted coffee. And I heard Bob say he was going to Corpus Christi tomorrow. You did say that, didn't you?
Yes.
Then this will work out just great. Oh, Papa, you remember a couple weeks ago when I told you I wanted to go to Austin, and you said it would be all right if I could get someone to take me to Corpus Christi to catch the train?
Yes, I remember. But I don't know that this is such a good time now.
Oh, why not?
Alice, you know what just happened. Do you have to ask why not?
Well, Papa, it didn't happen in Austin.
She's got you there, Richard.
All right. You can go to Austin. How long will you be up there? Remember, we're starting a cattle drive north, and I'd like for you to be back before then.
But neither you nor Bob will actually be going on the cattle drive, will you?
No, but I'd like you home before the drive starts.
All right, Papa. I'll be visiting Loretta Dixon, and I won't stay longer than a week, I promise.
And then, if it's all right with your mama, it's all right with me.
Oh, thank you, Papa. If you say it's all right, then Mama will be a cinch.
After Kleberg put Alice on the train heading for Austin, it took only one exchange of telegrams for him to learn that Jack Brandt and Wiley Stone had been released from prison. That meant that King wasn't imagining things. It probably was Brandt who'd raided the ranch, particularly given his penchant for beheading his victims. question was, why? Was it some sort of twisted revenge for what happened to him during the war? Since none of the cattle were stolen, Kleberg had to believe that it was something like that. So, what now? Should Kleberg ride the 40 miles back to the ranch to ask King for permission to call in the Texas Rangers? Nah, that would be just a waste of time. King had already made it clear that he didn't want the Texas Rangers involved. Something had to be done. The only question was, what? Suddenly, Kleberg knew what it was, and he took it upon himself to send the next telegram. In the telegram, he asked an old friend for help. Kirby Jensen never really knew his mother, and when he was barely in his teens, he went with his father into the mountains to follow the fur trade. The pair teamed up with a legendary mountain man called Preacher. For some reason, unknown even to Preacher, the mountain man took to the boy and began to teach him the ways of the mountains, how to live when others would die, how to be a man of your word, and how to fear no other living creature. On the first day they met, Preacher, whose real name was Art, gave Kirby a new name that over the years would become a legend in the West. After a while, even Kirby thought of himself as Smoke Jensen. Preacher was with Smoke when he killed his first man during an Indian attack, and he took the boy in when his dying father left him in Preacher's care. Now, Smoke was in his 30s, a happily married landowner whose ranch, Sugarloaf, was said to be one of the finest in the whole state. He was in the kitchen of his house now, drinking coffee and leaning back against the counter.
Wish I'd been there.
Pearly was a shade under 6 feet tall. He was as lean as a willow branch, with a face tanned the color of an old saddle and wild, unruly black hair. His eyes were mischievous, and he was quick to smile and joke. But underneath his happy demeanor was a man as hard as iron and as loyal to his friends as they'd come.
Yeah, me too.
Calvin Woods was Pearly's young friend and protege in the cowboy life.
I suppose if you two had been there, you would have been standing over there with Smoke, staying out of it. Never mind that I was being accosted by two men.
From what I saw, you were the one doing the accosting. I never saw two galoots leave town so fast.
Miss Sally, would you really shot him in the,
You mean his privates? You're damn right I would have.
And she wouldn't have missed, either. I've seen her shoot.
Still, I could have used a little assistance. It would have helped me maintain a little female decorum.
Darling, you got common sense and guts. That's all the female decorum you need.
And she makes the best bear claws in Colorado.
Pearly, that's your fourth.
Well, maybe. But I think she just made them just a little bit smaller this time.
If you say so, Pearly.
They weren't no smaller. They was as big as always, just like your stomach.
Calvin Woods, if you don't start using correct grammar, I'm going to have Smoke make you start taking lessons with the school children in Big Rock when school starts up again.
You tell him, Miss Sally.
You know your language could use a little tidying up too, Pearly. I think listening to you talk is what has made Cal forget everything I taught him when he first came here. I don't know why I even bothered. And you, Mr. Smoke Jensen, I see you've been letting the boy smoke, and him not even out of his teens yet.
But, Sally, Cal is doing a man's work every day and living with the other hands in the bunkhouse. It wouldn't be right to tell him to work like a man and then treat him like a little kid, would it?
Oh, next you'll be giving him whiskey and sending him into town to learn about women and things.
Now, darling, you know I wouldn't do any such thing.
Oh, you men. You never know when you're being teased.
Speaking of town, I'm going to have to go back in today. I need a wagon load of fence posts and barbed wire for the north pasture. I don't suppose you'd like to go with me, would you?
Just let me freshen up a bit and we'll be on our way.
You know'd she'd go with you. Miss Sally takes to town like my horse does to sugar cubes.
Cal?
Cal looked at Sally with an anxious look on his face, wondering if he'd been out of line.
Node?
New.
That's better.
Pearly, why don't you and Cal get the wagon hitched up? That is, if you're through stuffing your belly.
Well, the truth of the matter is I kind of noticed that Miss Sally had a fresh apple pie cooling on the sill, and I...
You can come back and get some pie after we've left for town.
That's mighty nice of you, Smoke. Come on, boy. Time to earn your keep for a change.
Me? It ain't me that eats my weight in food every day.
Better watch that language, cowboy. Or you gonna be trying to squeeze your carcass into one of them teeny-tiny desks over at the school.
Smoke walked back into the bedroom just as Sally was changing her dress. For the moment, she was between dresses, and she stood there in a camisole and short bloomers. The sheer lingerie showed off Sally's supple body to perfection.
On the other hand, maybe we don't have to go into town right now.
Oh, you mean you don't really need fence posts and barbed wire?
No, I need them. I just mean I don't need them this very minute.
Why, Smoke Jensen, I do believe you're trying to take advantage of me.
Smoke wrapped his arms around her.
Oh, you better stop that right now, Mr. Jensen, or we aren't going to get to town anytime soon.
Like I told you, there's no real hurry.
As I told you, sometimes your grammar is as bad as Pearlie's and Cal's.
Pearlie and Cal, they'll be coming back.
Oh, you aren't going to let a little thing like that stop you, are you, coward?
Sally, for heaven's sake, have a little female decorum.
All right, if you say so.